Well, let me start by telling you a little bit about the Oxford Internet Institute, if it is indeed shrouded in mystery for you. We are a small but no longer the smallest department in the social sciences division of the university. We're completely multidisciplinary. We have political scientists, information scientists, computer scientists, geographers, historians, physicists, you name it. We have pretty much one of everyone within our halls. And the thing that draws us together is really our subject matter. We are all interested to a greater or lesser extent in the internet as our research areas. And it's an incredibly warm and productive place. I think that mishmash of different disciplines is something that I find very, very useful, and I think in this new territory of digitization, digital products, digital approaches, that multidisciplinary environment will be found more and more actually. So come and visit us. We are on St Giles, on both sides of St Giles now, at number 1 and number 34. There we are, that's the Oxford Internet Institute. My introduction to digital humanities really started, as much as you will have experienced, with digitisation. And I thought I'd say a little bit about the digitisation programme in the UK, which I think came largely through the AHRC, AHRB as it was back then, the New Opportunities Fund and JISC, the Joint Information Systems Committee, which I'm sure you've all heard of. The JISC in particular had a large-scale digitisation programme which began in 2004 and produced some really flagship projects. For instance, it digitised more than 1 million 18th century parliamentary publications, more than 3 million pages of British newspapers, spanning 3 centuries, almost 50,000 archival sound recordings, 500,000 pages of minutes and memoranda produced by the British Cabinet, over 1 million items of printed ephemera from our wonderful John Johnson collection in the Bodleian, and more than 3,000 hours of news film representing 60,000 news stories and programme scripts from ITN Reuters. A report by JISC in 2011 talked a little bit about some of the impacts that this digitisation on a large scale had had on the UK in terms of research, teaching, learning and public engagement with resources that are a really key part of our national heritage, national cultural heritage. So Simon Tanner and Marilyn Deegan produced this report and argued that there were at least 5 modes of value that can be understood to accrue from digitised resources: increasing options for users, the prestige of holding a cherished resource, the educational value of that resource, the existence value of simply knowing that something has been preserved, and the bequest value of passing along heritage to future generations. At the OII, we started thinking about this as a direct result of JISC's own realisation that it had digitised all these marvellous collections, but really it hadn't thought too much about what impact those collections had had, whether they were reaching those users that had been identified in the bids for funding. I find it amazing, actually, that this wasn't built into the original calls for funding, but I think this is still very much a fault in the framework of funding, that not enough money is sort of protected, is cordoned off for thinking about iterative design, adapting your digital collections to ensure that you are reaching those users that you wanted, or potentially new users that you need to know about. So in 2008, I joined the Oxford Internet Institute to do this project, the impact, usage and impact of digitised scholarly resources. It was designed to look at 5 key resources that JISC had funded. And it was also an exploratory project to test a number of traditional and new methods for understanding users and impact in digital environments. And one of the innovations that came from the Institute, from my colleague Eric Meyer, was to build this free toolkit for use by people involved in digital collections to use some of the methods that we'd found had worked, and to identify ways in which they might use these tools to think through some of the issues. So, here are some of the ways that we began to think about it. Firstly, audience. So all of these projects had gone to JISC and said, this audience who need to know about these collections, they need greater access to them, they need to be able to work with them in different ways. But had they reached those audiences? Did they know that they were getting to those users? That's one of the things we really needed to test out. Thinking about kinds of usage, you know, had the digitization of these resources attracted new kinds of usage? Were there surprises along the way in terms of what could be done? And teaching and learning, to what extent had these resources enabled new research questions or new approaches to teaching? So these are the original TIDSA methods, and as Harold said, I had come out of a doctorate in modern history, wasn't used to talking to people who could talk back to me and tell me what they thought. So it was a real baptism of fire working at the OAI on this project. Whoops, let me go back. I couldn't even pronounce some of these methods when I arrived there. But I think that was part of the reason that that I was brought in, actually, because the majority of people working with digital collections at that time were people who'd been working with analog collections, who'd been working with the manuscripts, with the records, with the images, and they weren't social scientists either. So as I worked my way through some of these methods, it was a great help in constructing the toolkit from the point of view of the most likely people who are going to be using it. So I made sure to write lots of how-to, easy-to-access guides, because some of these methods were easier to learn than others. Some of them have slightly fallen away now, particularly Webmetrics, which is link analysis, which is much harder to do now thanks to the search engines. But most of them are still very useful, and I used them throughout the projects that I'm going to talk about today, including a very recent one on digital art collections. So I can talk more about them if you'd like to know, but otherwise I'll whistle through at the moment. So we have updated the toolkit. We've had actually many successive rounds of funding from GIST to make sure it's up to date. And so we've recently added user guides to things like social media, understanding qualitative indicators of impact through social media. And we've got some fantastic people at the Institute. I'm not one of them, who can do beautiful visualizations of that data. So if you are interested in trying to find out more about some of these things, I can certainly put you in touch with people who know how to use them. So what did we find when we looked? Well, we looked at these projects, Bopcris, the 18th Century Parliamentary Publications, the two British Library projects, the newspapers and the archival sound recordings, HISPOP, which is the Online Historical Population Report, Census Reports, and the Wellcome Collection, we were looking at a large corpus of journals whose backfiles have been digitised. And I'm going to talk about HISPOP a lot today because they were also a flagship project. They were brilliant, and every method that we tried out worked with HISPOP. For one reason or another, which I'll tell you about. So the Online Historical Population Reports project digitised more than 200,000 pages of census and registration material for the British Isles, and it provides free online access to everyone to the complete British population reports for Britain and Ireland from 1801 to 1937. The documents are supported by lots of ancillary documents from the National Archives now, critical essays that were commissioned specifically for the digital editions, and transcripts of important legislation as an aid to understanding the context, content and creation of the collection. It began in 2004 and the website was launched in 2007. Now, HISPOP was our golden child for many reasons, but largely, I think, because it was led by then-doctor, now-professor Matthew Woollard at the University of Essex, who is a historian with a background in population studies and who was very familiar already with the original materials, having used them for his own research for a long time. And I think it was this real in-depth knowledge, not only of the materials, but the ways that historians would want to access that material, that led to the project's success. It had a really intuitive design that came out in lots of discussions with users. So in particular, he had experience in the variety of sizes of volumes, the complicated cataloguing processes and of the paper materials. He'd been corresponding with users for a long time, colleagues, as he would call them, before the digital project emerged. And he continued working with those users, corresponding with those users on his own time, long after the digitization project funding had finished. So one of the things that I think we would advocate, having done some of this research, is that you maintain a sort of pipeline to your users. You need a really well-managed email contact, a personalised contact. As Melissa was saying last week, it makes a big difference to contact somebody who knows what they're talking about, knows what you're talking about. And Matthew had kept that contact going for a really long time and had taken a lot of time out of his own working life to maintain that side of things. The interesting thing is that having all of that experience and all of that contact with users, he said very confidently at the beginning of the project, I know exactly who's going to be using this material. I can probably tell you the names of most of those people. I definitely know that we've hit our audience, so don't worry about that. But actually, we found that largely those users were who he said they were, but there were loads more as well, and there were lots of different kinds of users that he hadn't anticipated, and that was really exciting. So let me tell you a little bit about what we did. So this is from the log files, the HisPop log files, which had been really carefully kept and cross-referenced with activities that were going on in the project. So the one of the things you learn from log files is what phrases and words people are using to search for your collection. And they got top marks because they'd come up with this really nice, catchy acronym that didn't belong to anything else, didn't produce horrible, unsuitable images or lots of images, you know, lots of pages about cats or anything like that. It was really catchy, and lots of people knew about it. So when they were searching for HisPop, they knew that what they were going to be getting. It's really worth taking a look at some of these things. You can do the same thing through Google Analytics. It gives you a sense of what people are looking for when they hit you. And for example, if it's one thing that HisPop were quite concerned about, was that they would attract lots of attention from genealogists who potentially wouldn't be finding what they wanted through the site. They wanted personal information about relatives, not general context that they could find through the census reports. But actually, there's lots of really great information in those reports that could give a really rich context to their own relatives' story. And so if you know those people are going to be coming to your site, putting something on the front page that invites them in and allows them to understand what is there for them is a really good idea. So we were also able to see what time of day the researchers were likely to use HisPop. This was really interesting to me. And we were able to cross-reference this data with country of origin data. So the worldwide use is sort of indicated by the fact that there's quite a lot of activity going on through the British night. Either academics are really keen to get in there, they'll just, you know, they won't sleep, they've got to be there looking at HisPop, or else people are coming from other parts of the world and using the material as well. One thing we did actually was a survey of all sorts of different users. These are a number of different projects, some of which were the target projects in our research study, but others were similar types of project or similar types of materials, so that we could get a sense of where our projects fitted in a sort of ecology of other resources. So you can see that HisPop non-UK awareness is actually quite low. UK awareness too is quite low when you compare it to things like British Library newspapers or the House of Commons parliamentary papers. But it also reinforces Matthew's idea that it would have a sort of small but very loyal, very engaged community of users. So not that many people know about it, but all the people who need to know about it are accessing it.
So what do those percentages represent?
Awareness. So the number of people that we polled. Okay. So there was a questionnaire. Sorry, I should have said that. We did a questionnaire. We reached something like 600 users. This was the percentage of awareness of these different projects amongst the likely users. Okay. So, The perception was that this was a really niche resource that was somewhat borne out, and that it was transforming access for those known users and usage patterns. That was certainly borne out in our study. We found that it was much more embedded in educational resources than the project team had expected, and that had had this really interesting set of impacts on the ways that people were teaching. So, for instance, we interviewed a lecturer in historical geography from university in London, who had said that he was using HistPop to expose students at a much earlier time of their undergraduate degree to primary sources, and allowed them a bit of freedom to explore those resources, which you wouldn't necessarily get in at that stage of their career. And he'd said that that had led to a sort of surge in final year dissertations of really high quality, simply through that sort of familiarity of working with the material. So he said, I think the students scored so well because they'd already been used to dealing with historical documents, and using HistPop as a teaching tool really early in that process had fed into those really high quality dissertations. Another one that we found said it made it possible to do a completely different kind of project. So, for example, one member of academic staff that we interviewed said that it was a great way of guarding against plagiarism because of the type of encounter that it produced, the sort of the type of educational experience it produced. It was impossible for the students to cheat. They had to go and interact with it themselves. So it had a variety of different impacts on undergraduate teaching. We also found it very highly represented in continuing education courses with non-traditional learners who are able to access real primary documents in a way that they might not have otherwise been able to. So what else did we find? Interviews with one project revealed the importance of user studies to ensure that all stakeholders continue to have a voice. So in some projects, the digital project team were quite separate from the people who had been guarding these materials for a really long time, who knew intimately the types of users that they might expect, the types of usage they might expect. And so that sort of division between those two project teams meant that the original custodians couldn't feed their knowledge about users to the digital project team, and they weren't receiving data about the online users, so they couldn't make any statements about whether they were the same or different new users. The project teams tended to have a sort of positive view of the work only, and others felt that the digitization had increased tensions actually in the broader setting because there were these two separated views of usage, and that was a shame. On a slightly happier note, a very strong theme in the project was the serendipity, the great wonder of serendipity in discovering new digital resources. So I've got two examples for you: the British Library Archival Sounds Project, digital sound archive, and the Wellcome Library Journals project. In the case of the British Library, they digitised more than 12,000 items from the sound archive, almost 4,000 hours of segmented recordings in the first project, so about 185,000 tapes. And users said things like, the Archival Sounds project made the sound files completely accessible, completely discoverable in a new way. What I found most enjoyable is the serendipitous nature of the resource. I didn't have a clue about some of these African music recordings, and I found some wonderful stuff. I found a whole series of radio programs I didn't know existed, a whole genre of music, jazz from Soweto. It was great. That was a great moment, dipping in and out of things. It's completely impossible with the sound archive. You have to know exactly what you want because someone's got to go and get it for you. So the digitization of the sound archive materials meant that people who wouldn't have a clue what was in those archives could just discover the types of materials that, that were there. And I think that was a great aim of the project, actually, was to increase and the variety of different users of the materials, to simply expose people to the sorts of things that were there. And they went on to have some really interesting projects to tag their recordings with various things, because, of course, they contain a huge amount of information. So user tagging started to unlock that content for the first time. Similarly, with the Welcome Project, which digitised complete backfiles of a number of really important culturally and historically significant medical journals, like the British Medical Journal, about 3 million pages, all through PubMed Central, of all places. One researcher in social history of medicine said, it allows me to be much more comprehensive in my research, but actually I'm a great one for browsing, that's why I like having books on the shelf. If I'm looking for a particular paper, and it's in the Journal of Physiology, I like to look through the whole issue and see, you always see something else that's interesting. I've found interesting things that I haven't necessarily found in the past. And again, users reported finding things like the advertisements in the back pages of the British Medical Journal simply by compulsively turning the pages to see what else was there, and discovered this huge new treasure of archival material. So there are lots of really interesting representations that drive to go to the library and simply flick through the pages that we all like to do. That hadn't gone anywhere. We're still doing the same things that we always had been doing, just in a slightly clickier way. So through successive rounds of funding from JISC, we were able to expand the number of case studies. And these are all contained within reports in the TIDSA toolkit if you want to go and explore them a little bit more. So a huge number of usage and impact studies were commissioned from all of these different places, and produced some really interesting results. So for example, this is an indication of the visitors per month and page views per month and percentage of UK traffic from these projects. So it's a Vision of Britain, British History Online project called Humbox. Remember what that one is? Siobhan Davis Replay Project, which is a dance archive. And the one that's really interesting at the end is University of Oxford Podcasts. Now, you can see the difference between, for example, Siobhan Davis, which is, for example, 10,000 page views per month, and University of Oxford Podcasts with 30 million plus page views. And the reason I put this slide up is because it's not just a numbers game. You know, there's a real temptation, I think, with digital projects to count the number of clicks, the number of visitors, the number of page views, and also to sort of compare, where comparisons aren't really all that useful. The reason I like to talk about Hitchpop a lot is because it had this sort of small community that actually was quite a lot bigger than they thought it was, but they knew who they were reaching, and it was a really transformative, important project that had been created. So, you know, I think it's really important to compare to other digital projects in the community, but to be realistic about what you can achieve with your project, and to do the sort of qualitative work to understand what sorts of impacts that's having.
So Oxford Podcasts are attracting a million views a day. 4 out of 5 of them from outside the UK.
Yeah, per month, page views per month.
Yes, that's a million a day.
Yeah, a million a day. Yeah, so at the time that this data was collected, they had very fortuitously, serendipitously perhaps, been featured in an Apple advertisement for, I think, an iPad. So there was a huge surge to the University of Oxford podcast, but actually their numbers were pretty amazing throughout their collection. Quick note about citation habits. So one of the methods we used was sort of standard bibliometrics. What we found was that historians don't like to cite digital resources, or at least they certainly didn't back then, and I'm told that they still don't. When we asked people if they'd published a piece of work, lots of them said yes, and when we asked them, how did you cite? Absolutely no way I would cite the website. And that was partly, I think, you know, we're talking a few years ago now, so we're worried about unstable URLs and sort of permanence of those links. But also when we interviewed some undergraduate students about why they were failing to cite some resources, there was a real concern that using digital resources was seen as sort of not quite the done thing. It wasn't really proper history. They weren't using proper research methods, and the contact with the materials wasn't authentic enough to reference for their supervisors. And so while they were doing a lot of research online and they were finding these incredible digital collections and they were really immersing themselves in them, they weren't giving that proper credit in their work. And again, HISPOP came top of our class in this respect, because they had done something really clever and nudged their users. So they'd put a really small piece of text underneath each document saying, if you cite this document, use this link. And so if you make it really easy for people to simply just chop that piece of text out and reproduce it, they're much more likely to keep the URL in, although I'm sure that lots of people chopped it out as well. But they had significantly different results, as you can see there, by using that nudge. Every one of the projects we worked with has said that it was really, really satisfying and really enlightening doing this sort of study. So when I talk about the TITSA toolkit, I often do so with Judith Seifring from the Bodleian, from the EBO TCP project, who was one of the JISC-funded projects commissioned to use our toolkit to understand their users better. And she found a huge amount of valuable information, all of which is available on the TITSA toolkit in a case study. I think they offer a really valuable opportunity to revisit project goals, intended audience and impacts, and like I say, to adopt a really iterative approach to further development. So one of the participants said, what was most helpful were the interviews we carried out with academics and the focus group sessions we held with students. In these, not only did we get useful answers to the questions we posed, but several important issues were raised which we hadn't anticipated. I think it's so important to listen to your users, because even if you're really experienced at working with materials, you really think people know what you think you know what people will want, there are always surprises, there are always new uses, new experiences that you need to consider. And of course, when you involve the crowd to build part of your digital resources, you can increase the range, and if you're successful, the number of users of those collections, and also the opportunities to learn more about them. Crowdsourcing projects offer numerous opportunities to gain new knowledge about the ways that the public interact with resources. Who's volunteering? Who's creating? What motivates people to get involved? How does the design of certain crowdsourcing endeavours or tasks affect participation and creativity? And what impact can public involvement in such projects have on a wide range of stakeholders to make engagement with cultural heritage resources richer, more open and more responsive to visitors? These projects largely propose tasks that can't be automated, so they require a human being to participate, whether to tag digital art, to transcribe handwriting like we saw last week. So they can tell us a huge amount about what it is about us as human beings that wants to work with these materials, wants to engage with them. The internet offers the possibility to navigate through these resources online, but crowdsourcing projects reveal the need for a human interpretation of those resources and a humanistic architecture for exploring them. So understanding interactions in this environment can, I think, shed light on the drive to create and consume cultural objects and the role and function of those objects in our communities. So I'm going to tell you a little bit about the project that I worked with for my HRC award that Howard mentioned. It's called Your Paintings. It's a collaboration between the BBC and the Public Catalogue Foundation, which is a charity set up in 2003 by Fred Holler to capture, record and publish details of all of the oil paintings in public ownership in the UK, and there's well over 200,000 of those. So the Public Catalogue Foundation took quite a broad definition of public ownership, so it cast its net far wider than museums, galleries, to include other obvious institutions in which you might find paintings, such as town halls, libraries and schools, but also universities, hospitals, lighthouses, fire stations, you name it. They went everywhere to take these pictures. The original intention was to publish fully illustrated regional volumes, beautiful books. I have several in my collection. They are absolutely gorgeous. But of course, it was very obvious quite soon after the project began that web publishing was the real solution. So following the PCF's partnership with the BBC, the data and the digital images from the Public Catalogue Foundation's project are now publicly accessible and searchable through the Your Paintings website. And if you haven't come across it before, I really do urge you to take a look. It's a wonderful collection. It's designed, built and hosted by the BBC, but they work very closely with Galaxy Zoo to create the interface and the task that invited the public to come tag the paintings. And that looks like this. It's Your Paintings Tagger. And it's completely addictive. It's a really nice interface. So you basically say what you see. So differences in the way in which curators and the public describe museum objects are well documented, and the impact of social tagging, which can have a really dramatic effect on engaging audiences, creating new terms not found in museum documentation. Social tagging, as my colleague Andrew Gregg has pointed out, flags up words and concepts that are likely to be used by other people of similar backgrounds looking for those paintings and with those attributes, providing a set of search terms designed by and for the widest possible set of users. So in Your Paintings Tagger, there's a free text tagging tool for things and ideas, as well as a more structured tool for names, types and subjects. And while terms are checked against things like the OED and DBpedia for crosslinks to Wikipedia, taggers can override these if they want to, creating sort of folksonomy. So, let's go back. I was going to show you what success looks like, but actually, I want me to go a little bit further forward. There it is. This is what success looks like when the tags are finished. So you can see all of the tags that have been added by the taggers here to describe this painting, where there's really quite a lot going on. I must say, one of the complaints of the taggers was that there were an awful lot of important civic figures, and so they described a lot of mayoral robes and collars and austere-looking gentlemen. But there are also lots of interesting, perhaps more diverse paintings like this one, where there's an awful lot to describe. So success. This was taken off the website yesterday. So there are more than 11,000 taggers. Almost 6 million tags have been created. 188,644 paintings being tagged right now. But as you can see by the indication on the brush, there's an awful long way to go. So in terms of trying to get through the collection, it would take a very, very long time if things continue at this speed. But for my purposes, we know an awful lot already about who's participating. So the majority of taggers are women, aged between 56 and 65, mostly based in the UK. Pretty evenly split between retired and working full-time. I got really excited about this statistic, so 81% visit art galleries pretty often. Almost 20% hardly ever visited galleries. I was really interested in that 20%. Maybe we'd converted lots of people who hadn't been to galleries and hadn't had that sort of facility with art before. But actually, when I went to talk to those users, those taggers, the majority were previously very actively engaged in local museums and galleries, but had either had life events that had prevented them from physically going through the door, disabilities. There are a whole range of different reasons why they weren't able to physically visit those institutions anymore. So we found that the tagger had actually enabled a link to grow between themselves and an institution that had broken away, that had fallen away somehow. Lots of them had never previously contributed to a crowdsourcing project before and were vehement that they wouldn't touch another one because they were so loyal to the tagger, which was brilliant. And like most crowdsourcing projects, we had lots of what we called super taggers, who were a tiny percentage doing the majority, the lion's share of the work. They were very competitive as well, so at one of the focus groups I held, there was somebody sort of standing against the wall. beady eyes sort of boring into everyone else, and I went to make conversation, and this person said, I'm looking for the number one tagger, I'm number two, and I want to know who number one is. Do you know? I played innocent. So it got very competitive about it. There were some really interesting surprises and interesting workflows that emerged through talking to the users. So for example, the super taggers really enjoyed the randomness of the process. You had no control at the time that I was studying the project what painting you would be faced with. So you could dismiss one if you weren't interested in tagging it, but you would see it. Whereas now you can tag by collection, you can create sub-collections that you're interested in tagging. So the Public Catalogue Foundation said, well, this is a real disincentive, we need to change the platform a little bit to ensure that people can choose. But some of the most interesting findings, I think, came from that exposure to art. So for example, hardly anybody wants to tag the abstracts. But lots of taggers said that they felt really a lot braver about looking at different types of art, having been confronted with them through the tagger. So they weren't going to tag them, but they did. It did have an impact on them, simply seeing it, simply being presented with it in that format. Taggers spent far too long, much more time and effort, tagging paintings than the PCF said was necessary. So at one event I went to, they said, stop doing it so carefully, we don't need you to do it so carefully. Just do it quite carefully and then just move on to the next one, because we've got a long way to go. Look at that brush. Oh my goodness, it's going to take us years and years and years to get this done. But they created these amazing workflows and they described them in great detail to me. So there was, most of them were using two laptops or iPads and various different combinations so that they could look information up on one. They could use the iPad to get really, really close in to describe detail. There was somebody who'd become an expert on different kinds of lace collars simply by seeing lots of them through the tagger and then finding out more and more information about them, and felt really frustrated that she couldn't go back and change some of the tags that she'd applied to earlier paintings, because she now felt that she'd acquired all this knowledge that was really important and should be recorded somehow. Whereas the way that the algorithms work, several people have to produce the same tags in order for them to be promoted to the database. So a lot of this work was being, to some extent, lost in the short term, because only those most popular terms would pass through to the database for the BBC. So the super taggers were spending more than 30 minutes researching while tagging a single painting, and they'd developed lots of strategies for tagging more accurately. But lots of them didn't know about this other tool called Art Detective, which the PCF have launched and relaunched, which allows you to create lots more knowledge about the paintings and simply to say, I just really like this, this is really my kind of art. So they kept saying, don't do this, do less, but, do less work on a single painting, just do it to more paintings. So this was the real meat of the study for me, the impact on the taggers. So through the questionnaires and the user interviews that I did, I found that museums visits, gallery visits increased amongst the taggers. So they felt that they were definitely showing more of an interest. And in fact, they were traveling quite a large distance to some institutions, some galleries that they'd never heard of before, either to visit a painting that had particularly affected them through the tagging process, or simply to see what else that collection had to offer. They felt that they had this increased confidence in viewing different types of art, and so they were much braver at attempting new experiences in art galleries. They wouldn't necessarily walk past things that they would ordinarily have found too difficult, they would stop. And I think that shows a real increased confidence in viewing. In engaging with art, which is really important to note. Lots of people felt that their skills in language had really developed as a result of the project, simply having to find that exact phrase or that exact word to describe something. And I think being prompted by that database, do you mean this or do you mean that, to help them sort of think, do I really mean that or do I mean something else? So that just the process had been really useful. And I found lots of teachers actually had been using the tagger to elicit exactly that kind of response in their students, to increase their felicity with language. It had provided a really important and positive distraction from various things that had been going wrong in people's lives, something felicit. slightly hinted at this last week, and I found it in spades with my taggers. Somebody had used it to stop smoking. Every time they felt like a cigarette, they would go and tag painting instead. There were lots of instances where people were out of work and they weren't able to do the sort of normal volunteering. So this kind of virtual volunteering had allowed them to rebuild their self-esteem and find a sort of a purpose. The Public Heslop Foundation hadn't really invested in getting people together. There weren't any forums available, which you'd find on things like Galaxy Zoo or other Zooniverse projects. So they hadn't sort of prompted people to meet up. But there were a series of events that I was involved in doing the project, and people were really interested to get together, either to spy out who was number one tagger when they were number two, but really to talk through some of those issues of, you know, oh, I really hate it when this happens, or, you know, I really find that this kind of tagging is really difficult. What do you do about it? Those sorts of conversations happened a lot when I was doing the project, and I thought that this was a really important thing to note for future projects, that these types of events can be perhaps a way of reinvigorating those physical spaces that we often feel might be under threat if we digitise collections. You know, people might not walk through the door anymore. This is a great way of ensuring that people do walk through the door. So, progress. Technology marches on, and Professor Andrew Zisman from this university, his visual geometry group has been working with your paintings since my project finished. They said if a human can do it, a computer should be able to do it. And they've been working coding using about the 3.5 million or so tags provided by the taggers to build a sort of image recognition software. So it goes through three stages. Firstly, you gather all the paintings tagged by taggers with a particular subject, say horse. Then you use feature extraction processes to build a sort of object model of a horse, so a set of characteristics that that painting might have that would indicate that a horse is present. And then thirdly, you run this algorithm over the whole database and you rank paintings according to how closely they match that model. And so they tested this model on the really earnest taggers, the super taggers. And they got a lot of work done. So the results were really impressive, but unsurprisingly not perfect at this stage. Taggers were shown paintings of about 50 paintings at a time, and they could turn the borders green, red, or amber. So amber was not sure if you couldn't quite discern whether something was in there. Over the course of 2 months, 250 taggers made almost 1 million selections and tagged almost 100,000 individual paintings with 200 varied topics. So, you know, this is great. This is brilliant that this computer can do this. But what about all that stuff that we saw on the previous slide? What about all these amazing impacts that this had on the community? I can't help but think that projects like this one and the transcriptorium that Melissa was describing last week means that we're kind of marching a little bit too fast. We haven't quite understood what's happening with the crowdsourcing projects yet. What is it about engaging with this sort of task that makes that enriches people's lives, that has these really incredible impacts on them? I think, like with the digitization, we haven't spent enough time thinking about those users and what we can understand about those encounters to enrich every aspect of our encounters with cultural heritage. And I think we're missing a trick, because I think by learning from the crowd of users that come to our digital collections, we can understand quite a lot about this, the value of the humanities to all of us. And something that really interests me, which is the links between cultural heritage and well-being. What is it that makes us feel better when we walk through the doors of a museum, or when we read some great literature, or when we listen to a beautiful recording of a great piece of music?